the job. He's got to walk extremely carefully, very slowly, very gently walk, because if his ankle twitches, if his foot twitches and creates a thrust upward of 1 foot per second, he's at escape velocity. He'll be moving away from the comet and never come back if he's not using his thruster that's on his spacesuit, his reaction control system. So digging in is not easy. On top of that, as it starts going to perihelion, the closest part to the sun, where the most amount of outgassing is going to happen, Mother Nature dictates that the outgassing is not going to be uniform. The north side and the south side are going to outgas by a different amount. Therefore, the outgassing is going to cause the comet to rotate at a different rate than it's rotating right now. That's not necessarily bad, because the camera that's on board of the lander is what we care about. The camera is going to rotate with the comet, so you'll be able to see what's going on the comet, just that as it rotates, you'll be seeing the sun zip by in the background, if you know what I mean. Sunrise and sunset might happen once every 10 seconds, so to speak. So it could be kind of exciting. I wonder if we know how fast the comet is rotating right now. I'm guessing right now it's rotating very slowly, but I'll bet you the amount of rotation and the angle of rotation is going to change at perihelion. WS2N, K2LAW, go ahead, Paul.
Well, I know they know the exact number, but I haven't read what the rotation rate is. But yeah, I'd like to see the pictures of the sun zooming by, you know, every couple of minutes or so, whatever it is. You know, I don't know yet. We're going to find out on the 12th, that's for sure. One other thing I wanted to make a comment about before I forget is the Antares rocket that blew up at Wallops Island. Looks like Orbital Science, did a company that's in charge of Antares, this private company, has got a $1.5 billion contract with NASA to put 8 of these Cygnus cargoes spacecraft attached to the space station. They've done 2 paid ones already. They actually did another one that was demo for orbital clients. You know, they have like 6 that they have to complete, and now they're talking about working with other companies and maybe even a foreign country to complete the deal. And they're not going to charge NASA, of course, any more money. They intend to honor their contract one way or another, because they've decided to do away with the AJ-26 rockets that were at one time very old, from the 1960 era, NK-33s that they had put on the Antares rocket for the last couple of flights. They're not going to use them anymore. That's it. So they have to find other ways to do it. That's going to be very interesting as well.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It's a little bit disappointing that the method of testing the rocket is not able to find the failure that's going to occur at a later time. And I think you and I discussed that last week. Each rocket has a finite amount of time that you can use it, because it does experience wear and tear. It's got a real hot flame on the inside that's slowly eroding away the metal, I'm guessing. Even if all the channels throughout the rocket motor are coupling the fuel that is trying to cool it, but still it's a limited amount of cooling, and any kink in that tubing, so to speak, can give you turbulence and improper temperature gradient and so on, which aggravates the problem. Designing a rocket engine is not easy. But getting back to landing on the comet, to set down that order is not an easy process. I thought about this with reference to an astronaut floating freely of the space shuttle. Let me drop and tell you what I'm talking about here. Let's say, for instance, an astronaut is floating freely outside of the space shuttle while it's in orbit, and he decides to back away from the space shuttle by, let me pick a number, 100 yards. computer on board, and he's able to blast himself back in the direction of the space shuttle and assume that his thruster is running low on fuel. So he only gets one shot at it. So he makes a burn, so to speak, so that he's now moving toward the shuttle. At the instant he touches the shuttle, he better make sure that he touches the shuttle in a place where there is a handhold. If he happens to touch the great big round bulbous radome on the front of the shuttle, where there's nothing to grab onto, as he and his spacesuit touches that radome, he's going to bounce off of it, and he's back into space again. If he's running out of fuel, he's in a lot of trouble. So he's got to make sure when he comes back, he manages to get back to the shuttle at a point where there is a handhold. Very similar to what's happening with this lander on Comet 67P. There's no real handhold for them to go down there. So sinking that orbit that's going to anchor them to the comet, that's a fairly difficult maneuver. They better be blasting a rocket in the backward direction at the same time they're poking forward with that probe. Or the probe better be a rifle shot. But even the kickback you get from that rifle shot is going to be pushing you away from the comet. You better hope the probe goes in, digs in, and now the tether on the probe allows you to hang on to the comet. Attaching yourself to that comet without wrapping a rope around the whole darn thing, it's not easy. Roughly how big is that comet, if you remember, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I think I read 1.1 miles. Diameter is a bad thing. It kind of looks like a dumbbell. So, what kind of harpoon? Did it say how many harpoons? One, two? I think they said harpoons, plural, so maybe it's two. And they're going to stop it. I'm assuming they're going to have some kind of, some kind of a charge to force the harpoon in a certain direction. And I'm imagining some kind of cable to pull itself toward the comet. And if 67P isn't made of steel, it should work, you know. once it pulls itself toward the three legs, now firmly on the surface, and these augers start up. I know each leg has an auger. And that's the idea, Dick. I don't get it. I mean, I agree. You know, you would need some kind of, maybe rocket blast going as this thing is drilling in. But I guess they're hoping that these harpoon effect things that they're going to use will be good enough.
But Newton's third law tells you every action has an opposite reaction. When you fire that harpoon toward the comet, you as the rifle holder of that harpoon, you're going to get a kickback. You better have some forward velocity at the time you fire the harpoon. If you had stopped your descent toward the comet 1 foot above the surface and you fire the harpoon, you better hope that harpoon digs in real nicely and you can grab onto its tether, because the process of firing the harpoon is going to be giving you a thrust away from the comet. Do you see what I'm worried about here, Paul? Go ahead.
The comet?
Go ahead, John.
Dick, maybe firing the harpoon is going to be incorporated in the braking action or the deceleration action. Also, if it's launched off of the craft and then has a pyrotechnic or some device on it, it can launch from the tether to the object. That would work too, and there would be no recourse to the craft.
No matter how you do it, it strikes me as a slightly delicate maneuver. And if the harpoon happens to go into very fragile material, it doesn't dig in real well. I think the landing process may take a number of attempts before you really get attached. I wonder if any of this has been explained to Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I haven't seen much on it. I mean, I've even looked at close-up pictures looking for these harpoons. I don't see it. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see what they're going to do. I envision, you know, like little rockets on these harpoons with cables, you know, launch these rockets, and this way you don't have to worry about, you know, it's war. Just like leave the land, fire these little, you know, thrusters on the harpoon right into the surface. But that's probably not it. That's what I was looking for. It's all going to be very, very interesting. I've got to make sure I'm near a computer on Wednesday to see how, you know, I'm sure they'll probably explain it in detail. Like, go on to the NASA site, go to European Space Agency. They have their own televised there. Excuse me, they have their own broadcast as well. But it'll be a NASA deal, I'm sure. We do have three instruments on board. You know, I mean, it's a small part of what we're doing. Although, we help out with the Deep Space Network. Back to you.
Now, John thinks that the lander will be proceeding toward the comet at the instant it fires the rifle that is the harpoon. That's what John thinks. I think John might be right. For there to be a rocket motor on the harpoon is less likely, because you'd like to watch the harpoon go down with your cameras. But if there's a rocket motor on the back end of the harpoon, the exhaust from the rocket motor is going to be fogging the lens of your camera. So that's not so desirable way to go. I think the harpoon fired like a rifle is the right way to do it. But another thing to worry about is that the actual distance between that comet and the Earth, I don't know the exact distance, but it's probably around an 8-minute time delay at the speed of light. So in this maneuver, it's got to do this whole maneuver of anchoring itself essentially autonomously, because from the time that we see the picture 8 minutes later and tell it, don't do this, do that, and then there's another 8 minutes for the signal to go back, it's at least a 16 minutes round trip communication, so that any information we get from its downwind camera is old news, if you know what I mean. So we've got to do this whole operation rather autonomously. It's got to have a lot of artificial intelligence. This better be a good design, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Comment? I did write down the times, by the way. Officially, it's 10:35 Eastern Standard Time. You can get a confirmation at 11:02, so that gives you an idea. You know, 27 minutes. So, yeah, I know it's out there. It's not 8 minutes. It's a lot longer than that.
Go ahead, John.
Well, how about if they were to launch it from the craft, this is the harpoon or whatever the device is, with a minor shove, even a spring action, very little motion, just enough to get it to go to the planet, and then when it, of the planet, the object, once it strikes, it could have like a healthy red on there, Paul, and do the driving from that. Wouldn't affect the craft either. There's a couple of ways they could do it.
You said the word healthy red. Is that something that fires itself on contact? What do those words mean, John? Go ahead.
I think it should have screws turning in opposite directions on the craft.
Yeah, we're going to get to Barry in a minute. John, what did you just say, and what were the meanings of those words?
Those are the charges that the healthy guns use. You know, the red is like a steel. You can drive a device like a hook or something into a steel girder with it. Extremely powerful, and they would do the job without a doubt. What do you think, Paul?
I've used them things. I don't know if you ever used one. They called it the Cannon Hilti. It was by Hilti. But I think I used the Brown Charge in that one. And that was even the steel. Yeah, that'll go into anything. I pulled that. The first time I used it, you got to kid me. it really goes right through the steel. It's unbelievable. And, yeah, maybe they got that. That sounds good, John. I know Barry was out there, Dick, so if you want to pick him up.
Barry, two counter-rotating screws sounds good, but there's a catch. Until that first thread of the screw digs in below the surface, turning the screw doesn't do you any good. You still have to apply a vertical force to that screw to make it penetrate the surface so that even turning it's going to do any good. Make believe you and I were installing an earth screw anchor in your backyard on Beach 43rd Street. You know you'd have to apply quite a few pounds of vertical force before that earth screw anchor would start doing its thing. N2MB, K2LAW.
Yeah, I'm thinking if the screw was turning, you know, like a drill bit, you know, if it, you know, and it was turning pretty quickly, and there was a bit of forward motion as this craft comes down, I kind of think that would work.
Okay, so you would have the screw auger sticking out of the bottom of the craft, one or two of them, rotating. At the same time, the craft has been given an amount of velocity, let me pick a number, 1 foot per second of forward velocity. You know it's going to essentially, not crash, but bump into the asteroid. And the very first thing that's going to bump into it is your auger, which is turning. So it's going to dig in at the first contact. I like that. That may be better than firing the rifle harpoon, because I worry about the harpoon having action and reaction. Unless you've calculated ahead of time the amount of reaction you're going to get. Let's assume that firing the harpoon is going to give you half a foot per second of backward velocity, but you've got three quarters of a forward velocity before you fire. So that you're sort of guaranteed you're going to hit and still be moving forward after the fire. This is a difficult problem, Paul. As I said before, I give it some thought of what would happen if an astronaut's floating in space and he wants to come back to the shuttle. The very first time he touches the shuttle, it better be something he can grab onto. Otherwise, he's in a heap of trouble. WS2N, K2RAW.
You know, what is this comet made out of? Is it a spongy surface? Is it a hard surface? Anybody know?
I don't think they know. You know, Paul, there is a slim chance that this comet is just a great big pile of dust that's just barely holding itself together with its little bit of gravity. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, if it's iron, they could use some neodymium magnet stick.
Dusty surface.
I think it's very going to be a bunch of rubble, too. It's you got to look at this comet. It doesn't even look, it's not round. It looks like you could, you know, it looks like it could break in half. When it gets near the sun, I'm going to wait for this thing to break in half. That wouldn't surprise me. And I like Barry's idea. I take one screw in one direction, the other one in the other direction. But it's got three legs, so, I mean, two of them are going to have to be going the same direction. I wouldn't be surprised if they did something like that. But it's the harpoons that are going to, like, temporarily hold it to the comet. That's the idea. So you don't need thrusters, you know, shooting up as these augers are going in. They're putting a lot of faith in these harpoons. Dick?
Okay, so what you know about so far is it has two harpoons, and each one of the three legs also has augers that can get deployed after the harpoons. Is that the plan of action, Paul?
That's the way I read it. Let's find out if that's true. That's probably on one website, not a magazine, unfortunately. Trust the magazine a little bit better. Back to you.
Okay, the harpoon sounds good, but the harpoon only works if it's got a significant amount of forward velocity when it strikes the comet. Where is that forward velocity going to come from? If that's a rifle shot, you've got kickback when you fire that rifle.
I agree, and I don't know. Maybe it's a spring. I don't know. We'll have to see. And they want this thing. I did read that they wanted to make sure it's secure, not only, you know, initially, but this thing's going to be doing things when it gets near the sun. So they don't want things to be, you know, pushed off the comet because of some kind of, what would you call it, a comet quake?
The actual comet is sort of a dumbbell-shaped object. And between the two blobs of the dumbbell, there's kind of a valley. Has the selected landing site been in that valley between the two blobs? Do you know approximately where the selected landing site is, Paul? Go ahead.
It's landing site J. So that gives you an idea that there was ABCD, you know, C, all the way up to probably past J. But J is on one of the lobes. No, it's not on the bar. Because of the whole comet. And they actually chose J for more, you know, one of the reasons was because if they were in tighter toward the center, it would be in shadow too much. They need to keep it in the sun. This thing is solar operated. Of course, it's going to be recharging batteries on, you know, but they need as much sun as they can get. They don't want to be in the shade.
Do you believe the camera on board the lander can swing in azimuth and elevation so that it can cover essentially a whole hemisphere? In other words, will it be able to look out to the horizon in all directions on that comet and observe where the outgassing is coming from? What do we know about that camera? And is more than one camera, Paul? Go ahead.
No, I don't know, but I can't imagine that they have this camera that it's only going to be locked in one direction. It's automatically got, you know, some kind of motor actuators on it to move it. Whether there's multiple cameras, I don't know that either. Probably. I mean, the way they do things today, I mean, look at Curiosity. It has 17 cameras on board Curiosity. I can't imagine that the European Space Agency said, let's just send it up with one camera. And but I haven't read any details. I mean, for all I know, it could be a black and white camera, but I doubt that.
This spacecraft that we have sent to Comet 67P really is two craft. It's an orbiter plus a lander. And the first time they put the orbiter in orbit around Comet 67P, it sounded like they were in not a circular orbit, but a triangular orbit. I was confused by that. Is the orbiter really in orbit around that particular comet, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
There it is. Yeah, I saw that too. I mean, it was to get it into orbit, they went through this triangular motion. I think there was about four or five orbits of creating triangle after triangle after triangle. They did this based on the gravitational field of this comet. You know, it's not a one round thing. But now that it's in orbit, you know, it's not firing the thrusters. You know, have plenty of fuel on board. So, you know, to set itself up, it went through these triangular motions. You know, go in one direction, fire its thruster, go into another direction. And that's how it set itself up around the comet.
Compared to a planet, this comet is so much smaller. Its total amount of gravity is so small that I'm now wondering, is the orbiter really in a elliptical orbit around that comet? Or is the comet so low in gravity that all they've done is to arrange the so-called orbiter to fly a parallel path alongside of the comet at some particular distance? Which do you think it is, Paul? K2LAW?
I thought the same thing. I couldn't get an answer. But, you know, the comet might be turning below it, and this thing could just be sitting there. So, that would be the way to go. This way you could stabilize the Rosetta spacecraft, and you could keep the antenna, you know, focused to the deep space network that way. when you say when, you know, when we sent the, this spacecraft there, remember this is basically a European Space Agency mission. In fact, it was launched from French Guiana, the European Space Agency spaceport, Peru, South America. So, launched on an Ariane 5 rocket. Did a very good job. And it's a large spacecraft because of the, especially for solar cells, the panels are, I don't know, 60 feet or something in each direction. Stood next to it, you know, it would be like standing next to two Greyhound buses. Back to you there.
If I understand correctly, this coming Wednesday, November 12th, is when the lander goes down and tries to harpoon itself into the one of the big lobes of that comet. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and I have the Eastern Standard Time. Should, I think it's going to take about 4 or 5 hours after it separates from Rosetta. But landing time is 10:35 Eastern Standard Time. The signal confirming the landing is expected at 11:02 Eastern Standard Time this Wednesday.
Is that 11 a.m. or 11 p.m., Paul?
Oh, I didn't say. Okay, it's a.m. in the daytime. We don't have to be up in the middle of the night.
So you believe there is a website that's going to give us a blow-by-blow and a live picture as this event occurs. Is that true?
Go to the European Space Agency website. They have you can click on one of the things for their TV. I'm sure, I know they'll definitely have it. And I'm suspecting NASA will have it as well, because we do have three instruments on board that were sent up by NASA. And, you know, that's they've got a microwave instrument studies the process by which the gas dust leaves the surface. And that's by NASA. And then you got something called MIRO, something that's capable of observing the water, carbon monoxide, ammonia, methane, if it's got any. And another thing called ALICE, that's an ultraviolet spectrometer. So since NASA's sending these things up, there's a couple more with that spacecraft. They'll put it on their website, you know, NASA TV. It had nothing to do with NASA. Yeah, you want to see it, like some of the private missions by Dragon. They launch a rocket, you know, for Asia. You know, you won't see that on NASA TV. But this you'll see.
Good stuff. I vaguely remember, Paul, refresh my memory on this one, that once before we flew a spacecraft, we, meaning the people of planet Earth, flew a spacecraft to a comet or an asteroid, and this craft was not intended to land, but we did make it make contact with the comet or asteroid. We did sort of land it. Seemed like that happened a couple of years ago. Do you remember that event, Paul? Go ahead.
And that was Deep Impact, and they had an 800-pound thing that separated from the main craft and slammed into the comet, and a bunch of debris came up, and they took pictures of it. Remember that one? We've had a lot of flybys. We've had Dawn. Now have Dawn going into two different asteroids, you know, taking pictures. But the only impacts was Deep Impact. Also, Hayabusa. That was a Japanese one that went to an asteroid and tried to bring back material. It didn't work out too good. So now, this month, they're launching another one with an asteroid return, probably in the year 2020, something like that.
Yes, I remember Deep Impact, which sent a very heavy object at high velocity toward the piece of comet or asteroid, and by what it blasted up and what the orbiter saw, we gathered some good data on that one. I think there was ground observations also. But earlier than that, there was a spacecraft that very gently came down to the surface. It was
a spacecraft. That's an asteroid there.
Okay. So there was a spacecraft that came down to an asteroid. It wasn't intended to land. It wasn't the original mission. But since everything else had gone so well, they decided to bring it right up close, and I think it literally came in contact with the asteroid in a very gentle manner. That was a previous mission. Do you remember that one?
Still sitting there. That was Eros. Eros, the asteroid. And the near spacecraft did that. They were happy to have this thing orbiting it. And then in the back of their minds, they always said, oh, let's land it. And it didn't have any landing gear or anything. So it came down and it took pictures from the surface, like a big square spacecraft, the solar panels sticking out. They landed and they figured the solar panels were leaning, you know, on the surface of the asteroid. That was pretty cool.
Is that one still in contact with the asteroid, and are we still communicating with that one, Paul?
No, they stopped communicating with it, but I mean, it's still sitting there. Probably stayed with that a couple of months, I guess. But it's still sitting there, I think. Eventually, stopped communicating it with it because they had all the information that they needed from it.
But if it's sitting there, it can give you additional information as to temperature and outgassing and whatever. I'm a little curious as to why you would stop communicating with it. I'll admit that you don't have the funds to communicate with it every day, but wouldn't you still communicate with it once a month and say, hey, how you doing?
Oh, I agree. But that's what they do. I mean, you know, after a while, they feel they got enough science from it, and it's not going to give them any more. I guess they pull the plug. But that was Eros. Maybe whatever pictures or information that they could glean from it, they didn't have maybe any kind of detectors. Like they have on this thing, there's ten different instruments on board. They probably didn't have any set up for the spacecraft, except, you know, pictures, maybe a neutron detector, you know, from orbit. Don't know. I guess, you know, from what I remember reading, that they did get enough science off of this thing, and they weren't going to get any more. You have to pay people to keep it up. And I guess they pulled the plug for that reason.
I wonder if Eros has enough thrusting power left on board that it could back away from that asteroid again. And maybe an asteroid is extremely low in gravity, but is it possible to go literally in orbit around an asteroid? Or maybe the gravity of an asteroid is so low that any attempt to go into orbit wouldn't allow you to do that. Just the solar wind would blow you away from it, so to speak. What do you think, Paul? K2LIW?
I know that once they landed it, that was it. They weren't going to fire the thrusters to take off again, although they probably could have. I think I remember they were discussing that. But I don't think they wanted to take a chance. Maybe they were happy being there, getting whatever information they had for who knows how long after it had landed. But yeah, it was called the Near spacecraft, and went to the asteroid Eros. So, very cool mission. I mean, it spent a long time in orbit around this thing, and I think this thing wasn't round either. It was shaped like a giant big potato.
To your knowledge, Paul, has any spacecraft ever gone into orbit around an asteroid or a comet? Is it possible to go into orbit around one of these things? Or is the gravity they have so low that orbit is essentially impossible? What do you think, K2LIW?
Well, this Near spacecraft was in orbit around Eros for a very long period of time. All this detail. I think that's the one they also found a little moon going around. I'll have to check the internet. I believe that was a teeny tiny moon flying around Eros. And they got all the information they needed, and that's why they said, okay, now it's time, let's see if we can go down and land this thing. And that's what they came down at, like, you know, a meter per second or something. And whatever it was, just soft landed, brushed the shut off, and there it was. So, yeah, not only that, you've got the Dawn spacecraft that went around Vista for months on end. That's the one with the ion rocket, and then it left that asteroid, and it's on the way to Cirrus now. And I think it's the end of 2015, maybe the beginning of 2016. I think it's the end of 2015 that it will go into orbit around Dawn and stay there. Yeah, it's been done. Had a lot of flybys. Of course, spacecraft that have gone into orbit. I always liked the Stardust mission. That one went out to Built 2, another comet, brought stuff back. Been doing a lot of stuff out there, Dick. And there's more to come. Eventually, we're going to go to an asteroid and bring a piece of it back. I mean, people are going to go on the Space Launch System.
Picked up the wrong microphone. Very good. John, take a look at November issue QST Magazine, November 19, 2014, page 65. There is a picture of the plot of an 80-meter dipole. And you go through the mathematics of that one, and I just did. The 80-meter band is 13.3% wide. And if your definition of an ordinary dipole, where is it hitting 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, the answer is 5.5% of the bandwidth. So 5.5% of the bandwidth of an 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge wire in free space, which is around 200 kilohertz, 200 and some odd kilohertz, 230 kilohertz it covers, where it hits 2-to-1 Vizwa. And if you make it a three-wire dipole instead of a one-wire dipole, instead of 5.5% bandwidth, that can't be right. Calculated 4.6%. I made a math error here somewhere. I know that you get a little bit more bandwidth out of a three-wire dipole than out of a one-wire dipole. But page 65, November issue has got that. Do you have the November issue out there with you in the shop, John? KC2WGB, K2IW?
No, I don't, Dick. That's inside in the house. I usually read in the house. I don't read out here. But you say the November issue. I will check that out.
You're right. November issue, page 65, under the column of The Doctor Is In by Joel Hallis. W1ZR. So the hold on band, one of our widest bands, is the 80 meter band, which is 13.3% wide, but you only cover about 5.5% of that with an ordinary dipole where you hit 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Why in the world do they come up with a smaller percentage of bandwidth, 4.6% bandwidth, on the 3-wire dipole? I made a math error, obviously. But we'll figure that one out. Yeah, there's not very many places. I remember looking recently in the ARL antenna book and a whole lot of other books. I wanted to see a curve of what is the real observed data look like of standing wave ratio versus frequency for an ordinary half-wave dipole made out of ordinary materials at some reasonable altitude. I remember looking for that on a couple of occasions and couldn't find it. I was very happy to see it's in the November issue that Joel Hallis finally gave us a curve. It is a easy neck computer modeled curve, but that's good enough for the time being. When it comes to simple things like dipoles, I believe computer modeling. As you know, I have trouble with computer modeling when it comes to very wide sheet metal elements of a Yagi-like antenna. There, the modeling programs are really a pretty far left of center. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Well, it would be nice if somebody did a Woodward job again and spent some time on some of the new elements that they're using, like you are, and very wide width, high frequency, and see they could probably lay out some of the data that is not really available for people who are not doing it themselves.
Yeah, this is a whole area that has never been investigated that I can tell. And the whole reason why people think it has no value is that drummed into your head throughout all of the electrical engineering courses you take. If you're building a resonator, make sure it has high Q. Low Q resonators are very undesirable. They're lossy. They're broad in bandwidth. They don't give you much filtering. And a high-end insertion loss. So low Q resonators are considered bad. Therefore, the bottom of all of those Brown and Woodward curves, which are for fat dipoles, fat monopoles, which are low in Q, people reject and ignore that portion of the curve. I can tell by the way the curves, they're spread out there. There's less data there. I can tell that when Brown and Woodward did it, they thought they were doing it for academic reasons, but no one would really go there. And hidden in that data is some very desirable information. When it comes to an antenna, as long as you're using low-loss materials and you're not dissipating the energy as heat, the lower the Q, the better, the broader the bandwidth. A whole lot of reasons why it's desirable. So on an antenna, you want the Q to be as low as you can get. On a resonator, you want the Q as high as you can get. And sometimes, let me drop it. And sometimes you use a series of inductors and capacitors as impedance-matching devices, like an antenna tuner. You want the inductors and capacitors that are in your antenna tuner to be as high in Q as you can get. And you're about to marry that with an antenna, and you want the antenna to be as low in Q as you can get. You can see the paradox in thinking that's required to look at it the right way. People have been ignoring flat sheet metal wide antennas. And because their whole attitude is, we're going to model it first and then build it, they will never discover that whole class of antennas. I've been saying this now for 5 years. I haven't seen anybody other than me use this area. Everybody's been ignoring it. Over to you, John. K2LAW.
KC2WGB. What's even more sad, Dick, is the fact that the more people are using the modeling programs, they're never going to discover that using those programs because, like you say, we model first and then we build. Well, they're never going to get there. Not from there.
Yeah, I chose a guy who was working with us, a guy who had 20 years experience in the antenna building field for the Navy, working at what's that naval base right off Rhode Island? Why can't I think of the name of it? You probably know the name of it.
It escapes me. Not right now.
Yeah, there's a submarine base off of Rhode Island, and he's worked there for 20 years. This guy's named Dave. Dave worked with us for a couple of years at my last work assignment. And he had your boat.
Connecticut?
Could be. Was it Connecticut or Rhode Island? He was living in Rhode Island, and whether or not he worked in Connecticut or Rhode Island, I'm not sure. But that's
probably the case, because Electroboat is in Connecticut, if I remember correctly, and that's where all that nuclear stuff takes place.
His expertise was in HF antennas that worked on seawater, things that you deployed from submarines and things like this. They would float up to the surface and give you an antenna. But he was extremely good at high-frequency structure simulator modeling, a very good modeling program. And I had him model some of the antennas that we were building and testing. And the model gave results that were very different than the real world. And as you heard, at first we thought, well, we're looking at some kind of a quirk that's being displayed on the screen of a Rodin-Schwarz vector network analyzer. And we went to two other vector network analyzers, Hewlett-Packard or Agilent, and also Avantech. I think it was Avantech. And they all gave the same results, and then we went and actually used the antenna on a real RFID interrogator, RFID reader, and it gave the results that we expected. So the antenna is real. even though the modeling program says, no, it doesn't exist. And the modeling program, I'd like to think that at least got you into the ballpark. It just barely got you into the parking lot of the stadium, if you know what I mean. It got you into the town. Didn't get you into the ballpark. The modeling program predicted that it was, a kind of a nice antenna. But the actual antenna was really fantastic. To watch a plot of frequency swept performance on a Smith chart, where at very low frequencies the dot starts off at the perimeter of the chart, and as you proceed up in frequencies the dot proceeds toward the center, and then goes into the center and stays there and doesn't move for 150 megahertz.
Repeater, timeout.
I think you're looking for Groton, Connecticut, Dick.
You might be right. I'm not quite sure now. But anyhow, then the dot stays there for 150 megahertz of sweeping. The dot doesn't move. We called it the stalled impedance, and I'm going to send it on 915 megahertz. That's a lot of bandwidth. And then after the 150 megacycles, the plot finally leaves the center of the screen. And you can expand around the center of the screen. We thought that, well, it's going into the center and it's doing a corkscrew. It just goes to the center, the real center, and sits there, absolutely steady. For that 150 megacycles, you thought you were looking at a 50-ohm dummy load. And then all of a sudden, you proceed beyond the 150 megacycles and it starts coming back out of the center. Unusual antenna. I'd never seen a plot like that in my 40 years of working on antennas. Well, let's face it, only 15 or 20 of those years did you even have a vector network analyzer. It's a fairly modern instrument. I think Hewlett-Packard invented it somewhere around 1978, but it didn't become popular until the middle 80s. What's your best guess, John, as to when a vector network analyzer, and it wasn't even called that in the beginning, it was really called a combined signal generator and display device, vector display device. I think it was the middle or late 80s when they finally started calling it a vector network analyzer. And even then, when you bought one of those things from Hewlett-Packard, you had to buy a whole lot of extra doodads to do any real measurements. Over to you, John, KQLIW.
Very true, Dick, and those doodads are expensive. Yeah, I think it was mid-70s for HP, and I believe they may have been the first one to come up with that. Oh, by the way, I sent you a tear sheet for my network analyzer. Did you get that in your email? Did you have to look at that?
I think I did. That was the data sheet, and it was an awful nice-looking instrument. So, you must be up to about, 45 real good instruments in your laboratory right now, John?
No, it's way above that, Dick. Probably in the 80s, somewhere in the 80s. And total instruments, I don't even know anymore. It's in the hundreds, maybe 400 or 500.
Hey, John, you are a collector. Wow. You know anybody else on planet Earth that has close to the number of tester instruments in private possession that you've got, John? Go ahead.
Well, most of mine are also calibrated, Dick, so they're working. So it's not like they're collected junk. But no, I know of some friends of mine who have laboratories that are a heavier investment than I have, but no individuals. Nah.
You're one of a kind, John. You are unique. We always do that, but now we're sure. So this curve that you and I have been looking for, page 65, November issue QSD. I'm going to earmark that one because I'm going to be referring back to it. Depending on how you define Q. Now, one of the definitions of Q is half power bandwidth. Okay, where does an antenna give you half power in its response because of standing wave ratio? And the answer is where it hits something like a 5.83 standing wave ratio. At a 5.83:1, of all the power you send to the antenna, half of it comes reflecting back to you. So from that point of view, the antenna has got a Q of something like 7. But we amateurs, we don't go to a standing wave ratio of 5.83. Most of us will declare, in fact, most antenna manufacturers will say the bandwidth of an antenna is where it hits 2:1. And if you buy the premium antenna, maybe it's where it hits 1.5 to 1. But most antenna manufacturers, 2 to 1. From that point of view, the antenna has got a Q of close to 10. Which really means the energy you send to your dipole bounces back and forth 10 times where it finally gets radiated. That's been going on for the last 200 years, and there is no book I know of that says those words, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Yeah, and nobody pursues it because they have no idea. And, you know, first of all, look at the equipment they would have to find out. So most people don't have that. You were fortunate you were working in an area where you had whatever you needed. So, it's amazing how much the information is out there. It's in books. But to extrapolate it to areas that have not been covered is very difficult for the guy who is not an antenna engineer or an engineer or wherever you're working, whatever the subject is. But, interesting stuff. I love it.
Because of the way our schools operate, if a person decides he is going to dedicate his life toward antenna engineering, he goes to a good school, he gets his bachelor's degree, master's degree, maybe even his doctorate degree. He works for a good company. He works for the antenna engineering department of that company. And assuming he's been through that filter and survived that procedure, and we do talk about survival, when you're in your freshman year of any good electrical engineering school for the last zillion years, one of the things that they always do during freshman orientation is they tell you, look at the man in front of you, look at the man to your left, look at the man to your right, look at the man behind you. When you graduate, they will not be there. Roughly one-third or one-quarter of the students that enter an electrical engineering school will graduate from that school. Well, a few of them will graduate from some other school, but most of them are not there. They consider it a filter. It's a survival course. That's the way we teach engineering. Don't make it fun. We make it miserable. We make it so miserable that less than 50% of the students that enter that field stay with that field. Let me drop. Now, that's just electrical engineering in general. And now when it comes to a subset of electrical engineering called antenna engineering, how do you get an antenna engineer? You get a guy who's gone through that survival school mechanism, and then he's working for a good company, and you wait 10 or 15 years of apprenticeship in that company. At the end of that process, and he's still there, and he's still doing it, now you've got an antenna engineer. It takes something like 10 or 15 years of apprenticeship. I know there's a better way that antenna engineering can be taught. It's not that much rocket science. We've made it a hell of a lot more complicated than it has to be. In that last company I worked at, two of those mechanical engineers, really smart mechanical engineers, got interested in antennas, and I taught them antenna engineering. I wouldn't say they're the world's best antenna engineers, but in about 2 years, I taught them a good percentage of what they have to know in order to be able to build workable antenna engineers that can be squeezed into a particular package that will meet a certain set of requirements. So it can be done better. And the teachers of that subject right now are so afraid of the subject, they're afraid to make any changes to it. The curriculum for that subject has essentially no change since 1947, when the radiation laboratory set of McGraw-Hill books were written right after World War II. K2LAW.
VDH with a comment?
And that's why he blows through so many good engineers to the academic grinding survival school, W2TT2.
Yeah, very fine, Gordon. And VDH, go right ahead with your comment, sir.
Fine business, Nick. I was just listening to what you were talking about, the whole educational process. My full call is WA2VDH, and the handle is John. One thing I have found out with some of these schools, especially in the whole electromagnetics or RF area, is they'll start off or hit you with a course with all of this vector calculus, these gradients, divergence, curls, and all that stuff. And it just frightens people away. I was sort of fortunate in that I started at RCA Institutes with the OT3 program before I I transferred in the school, and I had a background from people who had worked in the field. But I remember when I was at CCNY, as soon as I transferred in, they had this course with all the gradients and divergence, and it just frightened a lot of people away. Go ahead.
What's really sad about this, John, is that the whole process is not obeying the usual servo mechanism feedback. A servo mechanism manages to move your load from point A to point B. Because of the feedback, it knows when it has arrived in the right spot. It knows when to apply more power, less power, braking force, and so on. In the educational process, you're trying to educate electronic engineers to go out in industry and be useful. Therefore, the electrical engineering professors should periodically listen to what industry requires. There should be a feedback process. There seems not to be. You go to a real antenna engineering department of a real company that's doing significant antenna engineering and design, and you ask them how often do they use curl, divergence, Maxwell's equations, answer is almost never. The only time they use that is after they've written a good article on an antenna design, they're about to present it in the IEEE proceedings on antennas and propagation, and now they add the Maxwell's equations material to give it erudition. But that wasn't used in the actual engineering process. It isn't done that way. Let me drop. I've interviewed a whole lot of June grads, whether it be master's, doctorate, bachelor, or whatever. I've interviewed quite a few June grads that were candidates for the companies I was working for. Quite often I've asked them the question, of all the courses you took, which course did you like the least? You know what the answer was. And you probably heard, there was one person I ran into who really liked the Fields and Waves course. And the reason why that person, a female, liked that course is that she was a mathematics major. She didn't have the vaguest idea what it really meant. She just loved the manipulation of those matrix equations. But most electrical engineers, a fair percentage of them, drop out of electrical engineering because of that course. And that course does not present, in my opinion, useful engineering information that you can use on a day-to-day basis. It does give you a kind of a foundation. It gives you a little bit of an understanding of how things work. But that's not the way people do it. Maybe you see it differently here, John. WA2VDH, K2LIW, the second hand. And we'll go to Gordon right after John. Go ahead, John.
Fine business. This is what I've seen, is that these courses, they seem to look nice as far as putting them in a catalog or something, but as far as being able to do any design work, they're just next to useless. And I've seen this happen where, for example, an electrical department will select an advisory committee, and yet the advisory committee will not have people on it that are in the RF field or in the electromagnetic field area of manufacturing, because nobody in that department has that background. Yes, you're right, there should be feedback from the industry, but it all depends on how they build their advisory committee to garner that feedback. But I agree with you, Dick. It's the electromag courses, and I remember it very well with all of the gradients and the divergences and the curls and del dot this and that. I remember those courses, and I remember seeing people get thoroughly disgusted from it. The only way it became reasonable is if you happen to take a fluid mechanics course along with it, then you can get a fairly good idea of what's going on. Back to you, Dick.
There's a lot of room for improvement there. No real feedback. In the case of computer engineering and computer science, there's a lot of feedback. And they change that course every semester or two to keep it current. But not this course. But one of those guys over there in New Jersey who's been through this course and liked it is Gordon, W2TTT. Tell us about that, Gordon. I'm having some fun with him. W2TTT, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, you ever hear this?
sick sense of humor. K2RIW and the group W2TTT. Actually, a